didn't have it today, but you played marvelously. Loretta Boss Parker, popularly known as the Vice President for Tennis. If Mr. Walton was out on a trip, his idea of making a tennis date would be to radio our aviation department when he was a few minutes out from landing and have them phone me with a time. I would get the call at 11, find him a partner, and he would be playing by noon. So tennis became my outlet for organized competitive sport and exercise. But my real passion outside Walmart has always been my bird hunting. I have to say it's probably my one self-indulgent activity. I loved it so much that I just made it part of my way of doing business from early on. I never did that much quail hunting growing up, not until I met Helen's father, who was dead serious about it. Anytime I was around Claremore, I loved to go out there and hunt with Mr. Robson, or Helen's brothers Frank and Nick. Her dad and I were both much better than average shots, and we got to be pretty competitive over the hunting. As I mentioned, Bentonville appealed to me because I could hunt quail seasons in four states. So during the season, I usually took off almost every day around 3 or 4 in the afternoon and went out to do a couple of hours hunting. I had an old hunting car I'd haul my dogs in, and I'd go find a farm or ranch I wanted to hunt. I learned early that the best way to get invited back was to go ask permission and offer the owner a box of chocolate cherries from the store, or, if he preferred it, a take of the game I shot. I've hunted all over these hills and valleys around here. John Walton. Until Dad was in his mid-60s, I really had to struggle to keep up with him. I thought I was in pretty good shape, but my tendency is to kind of walk along, take it easy, and enjoy the outdoors. I'd look up, and Dad would be out of sight. He hunted like Sherman marched through Georgia. When I asked permission to hunt, I always introduced myself as Sam Walton of Sam Walton's Variety Store down on the square in Bentonville. And I found that it really helped my business. When these farm folks would come to town to shop, they'd naturally do business with that fellow who hunted their land and brought them candy. I still meet folks today who tell me their father recalled me coming out to hunt their land in those days. As we began to expand, and I flew around more, I would throw the dogs in the plane with me so I could hunt between store visits. I had some crazy times with those dogs out on the road. Usually I made them sleep in the trunk of the car. But if it was old Roy, who was really more of a pet than a bird dog, I would let him sleep in my room with me, unbeknownst, I'm afraid, to the Holiday Inn folks. Once he got in a fight with a skunk, and I am ashamed to even think of what the next person to get my rental car must have thought happened in that thing. I held him by his hind legs and half-drowned him trying to wash him off in this lake, but we found out you cannot wash skunk off a dog very easily. Roy was probably the most overrated bird dog in history. He wasn't much of a hunter at all. He would point rabbits, for example. But the associates and the customers got a kick out of visiting with him in the stores, and once we put his name and picture on our private label dog food, it sold tons. Another thing about Roy that was very unusual, he was a great tennis dog. He would go with me to the tennis court and lay there, and whenever the ball went out of the court, over the fence or whatever, he would go chasing after it and bring it back to me. What I really love about hunting is the coordination and the training of the dogs. You have to develop a partnership with them. You have to motivate them, and they have to do their work reasonably well. From South Point Magazine, February 1990. "George, come in here to me. You're about to get your butt shot, George," Sam says. Then to a companion, "I think George might be a good one. He's hunting. He's got his nose into the wind, and he's hunting back and forth. He acts like he knows what he's doing. He may not, but he acts like he does. He backed the other dogs, and that was just purely instinctive. and a dog with me has to have some instincts. I pride myself on being able to train my own dogs, and I've never had a dog handler, like some of these country gentlemen friends of mine. I enjoy picking out ordinary setter or pointer pups and working with them, yanking them around and correcting them and yelling at them, and being patient with them. They've got to learn to find the birds, and then they've got to learn the discipline to hold them and wait for the hunter. I have had some dogs I couldn't handle, and Mr. Robson made a specialty out of resurrecting my failures. He liked nothing better than to take one of my cast-off dogs and fix it up, then give it back to me. Aside from training the dogs, I like being outdoors in all kinds of weather. When I'm out there, I'm not thinking about Walmart or Sam's or anything but where the next covey might be. Also, some of my best friends are people who like to hunt quail. I'm extremely prejudiced, but I feel like quail hunters are generally good sportsmen who've got a balanced respect for conservation and wildlife, things that I certainly value. As good as the quail hunting is around home, Bud and I got really taken with Texas quail hunting a few years back. We each got leases on ranches way down in South Texas scrub country, not too far north of the Rio Grande Valley. My place is about as simple as they come. Bud's is a good bit fancier. His has a swimming pool. South Point. Sam Walton's Campo Chapota is a rustic little cluster of trailer homes out in the vast middle of South Texas nowhere. This isn't the quail hunting of rich southern gentry, the kind with white-coated servants and engraved Belgian shotguns and matched mules and silver harness hitched to mahogany dog wagons. Sam calls that variety South Georgia quail hunting, and he's tried it, but it isn't really him. In case the ambiente of Campo Chapote hasn't sunk in yet, it is, to put it simply, all things not Trump. This is a camp where your host hands you your towel, points you to a bedroom in the trailer, and explains, "Don't let the noise in the ceiling worry you. It's just rats." Bud Walton. One time Sam and I got invited to a fancy quail hunt on one of those South Georgia plantations. They told us they'd pick us up at this landing strip, so we flew in there, and there were all these corporate jets lined up. Well, this guy in a Mercedes pulls up to get us. You should have seen the look on his face when Sam opened up the back of that plane and his five dogs came flying out of there. They weren't expecting anybody to bring their own dogs. They had to haul them in that Mercedes. As you can see, I'm not all work. I like to play as much as the next guy. And I have to admit, back around 1974, I was awfully tempted to take more time for myself, to step back and let Ron Mayer and the other guys run the company while I went off to enjoy life. Around that same time, Helen and I went on some of our overseas trips, although I'm sure I spent most of my time over there nosing around stores and doing business. So for the first time since I had begun retailing in 1945, I was beginning to back off from the business. I was getting slightly less involved in the day-to-day decisions and leaning a bit more on Ron Mayer and Ferald Arend, our two executive vice presidents. I was still chairman and CEO. Ferald, at age 45, ran merchandising, while Ron Mayer, who was only 40, ran finance and distribution. To handle the explosive growth, we were bringing on new people in the general office. Ron brought in a lot of people to handle data processing and finance and distribution. What happened then is the one period in Walmart's history that I am still the least comfortable talking about today. But everybody else has had their say on the subject, so I'm going to explain the events the way I saw them unfold and be done with it. As I look back on that period now, I realize I had split the company in half. setting up two factions which began to compete fiercely with one another. There was the old guard, including many of the store managers, remaining loyal to Ferrald, and the new guard, many of whom owed their jobs to Ron. Pretty soon everybody began to take sides, lining up behind either Ron or Ferrald, who didn't get along at all. What I did next, which seems totally out of character for me, only compounded the problem tenfold. Ferrald had been valuable in organizing the company as we began to roll out stores, but because of all the technology and sophisticated systems we were needing, I really felt at the time that Ron was absolutely essential to the company's future. In addition to his ability, he had a lot of ambition. He made it pretty well known that his goal, which I respected, was to run a company, preferably Walmart. He told me one day that if he couldn't run our company, he wanted to get out and run another one. So I thought about that for a few days, and I really worried that we were going to lose Ron. Then I said to myself, well, I'm getting pretty old, and we could probably work together. I'll let him be chairman and CEO, and I'll just enjoy myself, step back a little, and, of course, continue to visit stores. So I became chairman of the executive committee. Ron became chairman and CEO of the company. Ferrald became president. I moved out of my office down at the end of what they jokingly call executive row and let Ron have it. I moved into his office. I made up my mind to stay out of his way and let him run the company, telling myself that I would just check to see how he was getting along. Since I had really been letting other people operate the company day to day all along, I thought things would run real well this way. Well, I was no more ready to retire in 1974 at the age of 56 than the Arkansas sun is ready to start rising out of Oklahoma in the morning. But for a while I did step back and take off a little more time. I'm sure to Ron Mayer it must have seemed like I never took off at all. The truth is, I failed at retirement worse than just about anything else I've ever tried. Actually, I knew it was a mistake almost right after I resigned the chairmanship. I tried to stay out of Ron's way. The problem was that I actually just kept doing exactly the same thing I'd been doing all the time. I wanted to see my ideas keep flowing around the company. But I wanted Ron to be successful in operating the company and building an organization. Unfortunately, I just couldn't quite stay away from it to that degree. The situation was quite a burden for Ron, and would have been for any 40-year-old guy wanting to run his own company, I think. Meanwhile, the house was dividing up against itself. A lot of the newer, younger guys were lining up on Ron's side, and the older bunch who ran the stores were backing Ferrald. When I began to sense how deep this split really was, I got real agitated about it, and then I became even more involved in second-guessing everybody. Al Miles, retired executive vice president, Walmart. There was this thing between Ron and Ferrald. I wasn't too involved personally because I was out in the field then, but even out there, it was very apparent that two camps were building up in the company. You know, you almost felt committed to say, well, I'm on this team, or I'm on that team. We started seeing a looseness in our organization that had never been there, and things none of us liked were starting to happen regularly. The seriousness of running our stores and taking care of our people wasn't happening. And most of us, district managers, would get together and talk on the phone on Saturday mornings, and, you know, we thought we were going to hell in a handbasket. I'm not exaggerating. I mean, we really did. Also, I remember that when Sam started spending more time in the office, he was very, very intense. I kept hoping things would work out. And I should say this. Walmart showed real good numbers during this whole period. It was never a question of mismanagement. What we had was a semi-retired founder who didn't want to go away, on top of an old-line bunch of store managers at war with an ambitious young guy with big ideas of his own. Ferald Arendt. That period right in there was the only negative I ever experienced in my whole time at the company, which is pretty remarkable in itself. Sam always felt the need for his people to compete with one another because he thought it brought out the best in them, and most of the time it did. But this was a situation that just didn't work. When he stepped aside, it created a tough situation for everybody. Ron's people were loyal to him, and mine were loyal to me. Sam was saying, "I'll decide the things that need tiebreakers." That turned out to be a lot more things than he had intended. So once he realized how badly things were really going, he did something about it. I've always taken most of the blame for this mess I created, but it's also true that I didn't think Ron was handling some things as well as he should. I worried about his people skills, and I felt like the whole clique thing was really hurting our management at the store end, our most unusual strength. And I guess I was pretty unhappy, too, over some issues of what you'd call personal style. None of them really all that unusual in most corporate environments, but different from the way we had always done things around Walmart. I agonized over all this. I rarely lose sleep over crises at the office, but this time I did. I didn't want to disappoint Ron, didn't want to lose him. But the company was headed in the wrong direction. So finally, I called him in one Saturday in June of 1976, 30 months after I had given up the chairman's job, and just said simply, "Well, Ron, I thought I was ready to step out, but I see that really I wasn't. I've been so involved that in a way it has put you under a real handicap." I told him I wanted to come back in as chairman and CEO and have him assume another job, vice chairman and chief financial officer, I believe. My proposal wasn't agreeable to Ron, and I can certainly understand why. He wanted to run the company, and when he couldn't, he decided to leave us. Nobody believed it at the time, but although I was unhappy with some of the things going on under Ron's chairmanship, real unhappy with a few, I tried as hard as I could to convince him to stay and be part of our growth, even though he couldn't be chairman and CEO anymore. I said, "Ron, we are going to miss you. We're going to need you. And I think we're going to suffer a lot because you're not here." I offered him everything to stay, but he felt it was time to go. As disappointed and unhappy as he was, Ron said, "Sam, I know you're going to think that things are falling apart, and a lot of other people are going to think they're falling apart, but you've got such a strong field organization here and such loyalty from the associates and the managers in those stores out there and such loyal customers, and the company is so sound in its operating philosophies that I think you'll just move right down the road." I appreciated his expressing that confidence in us. I know he meant it, and I'll never forget it. In company lore, that incident became known as the Saturday Night Massacre. What followed became known as the Exodus. First, a whole group of senior managers who had been part of Ron's team, our financial officer, our data processing manager, the guy who was running our distribution centers, all walked out behind him. You can imagine how Wall Street felt about that. A lot of folks wrote us off immediately. They thought, as they have through the years, that we just didn't have the management to hold the place together. They assumed that Ron Mayer and all his folks were the reason we'd done well, and they just ignored all the basics we had in place, all our principles, keeping our costs down, teaching our associates to take care of our customers, and frankly just working our tails off. Throughout all this turmoil, Jack Shoemaker, one of our brighter, brasher young talents, had been making strong contributions to the company, and I thought he might just be what we needed to get us back on track. But when I named him to be Executive VP of Operations, Personnel, and Merchandise, passing over some folks who were older and had been with us longer, a bunch more of our managers left. It was a real bona fide exodus. And by the time it was over, I bet one-third of our senior management was gone. For the first time in a long time, things looked pretty grim. And at that point, I have to admit, I wasn't sure myself that we could just keep on going like before. As I said back when we lost that first lease in Newport, most setbacks can be turned into opportunities. And as things turned out, this setback presented us with one of the great opportunities in our company's history. Ever since David Glass and I had met at that awful Walmart opening in Harrison, Arkansas, I had been trying to somehow persuade him to work for us. He was a big deal at this discount drug chain up in Springfield, and I was convinced he was one of the finest retail talents I had met. For some time I had been after Ron Meyer to hire David, but he wouldn't do it. So when Ron left, David was the first person I went to see, and I finally talked him into coming to Walmart. I'm not saying that with David and Jack Shoemaker as executive vice presidents, David for finance and distribution, and Jack for operations and merchandise, we didn't still have some turf fighting left to do between the two sides of the company, but man, we had as much retail talent and firepower together under one roof as any company could handle. These two guys are completely different in personality, but they are both whip-smart. And with us up against it like we were, everybody had to head in the same direction. Once again, Walmart proved everybody wrong, and we just blew the doors off our previous performances. David made us a stronger company almost immediately. Ron Meyer may have been the architect of our original distribution systems, but David Glass, frankly, was much better than Ron at distribution, and that was one of the big areas of expertise I had been afraid of losing. David was also much better at fine-tuning and honing our accounting systems. He, along with Jack, was a powerful advocate for much of the high technology that keeps us operating and growing today. And not only did he turn out to be a great chief financial officer, he also proved to be a fine talent with people. This new team was even more talented, more suited for the job at hand, than the previous one. All along, the history of Walmart has been marked by having the right people in the right job when we needed them most. We had Whitaker, straight out of the get-after-it-and-stay-after-it old school, to help us get started. Ferald Arendt, a methodical, hard-working German, to get us organized. Ron Meyer, a whiz at computers, to get our systems going. Jack Shoemaker, a brilliant shoot-from-the-hip executive with a store manager's mentality, to blow us out of ruts and push us into new ideas we needed to be working with. And David Glass, who could step up in a crisis, keep his cool, and eventually get control of a company that became so big it was hard to comprehend. From day one, we just always found the folks who had the qualities that neither Bud nor I had, and they fit into the niches as the company grew. Then, every so often, we needed even better talents than we sometimes had on board, and that's when the David Glasses would come along. But there's a time for all these things. I tried for almost 20 years to hire Don Soderquist away from Ben Franklin. I even offered him the presidency one time, and he didn't come. But when we really needed him later on, he finally joined up and made a great chief operating officer for David's team. At any company, the time comes when some people need to move along, even if they've made strong contributions. I have occasionally been accused of pitting people against one another, but I don't really see it that way. I have always cross-pollinated folks and let them assume different roles in the company. and that has bruised some egos from time to time. But I think everyone needs as much exposure to as many areas of the company as they can get. And I think the best executives are those who have touched all the bases and have the best overall concept of the corporation. I hate to see rivalry develop within our company when it becomes a personal thing and our folks aren't working together and supporting one another. Philosophically, we have always said, submerge your own ambitions and help whoever you can in the company. Work together as a team. Chapter 11. Creating a Culture. Sam's establishment of the Walton culture throughout the company was the key to the whole thing. It's just incomparable. He is the greatest businessman of this century. Harry Cunningham founded Kmart stores while CEO of S.S. Kresge Company. Not many companies out there gather several hundred of their executives, managers, and associates together every Saturday morning at 7:30 to talk about business. Even fewer would begin such a meeting by having their chairman call the hogs. That's one of my favorite ways to wake everybody up, by doing the University of Arkansas's Razorback Cheer, real early on a Saturday. You probably have to be there to appreciate the full effect, but it goes like this. Woo, pig, suey! Woo, pig, suey! Woo, pig, suey! Razorbacks! And if I'm leading the cheer, you'd better believe we do it loud. I have another cheer I lead whenever I visit a store. Our own Walmart cheer. The associates did it for President and Mrs. Bush when they were here in Bentonville not long ago, and you could see by the look on their faces that they weren't used to this kind of enthusiasm. For those of you who don't know it, it goes like this. Give me a W. Give me an A. Give me an L. Give me a squiggly. Here, everybody sort of does the twist. Give me an M. Give me an A. Give me an R. Give me a T. What's that spell? Walmart. What's that spell? Walmart. Who's number one? The customer. I know most companies don't have cheers, and most board chairmen probably wouldn't lead them even if they did. But then most companies don't have folks like Mike Possum Johnson, who entertained us one Saturday morning back when he was safety director by taking on challengers in a no-holds-barred persimmon seed-spitting contest, using Robert Rhodes, our company general counsel, as the official target. Most companies also don't have a gospel group called the Singing Truck Drivers, or a management singing group called Jimmy Walker and the Accountants. My feeling is that just because we work so hard, we don't have to go around with long faces all the time, taking ourselves seriously, pretending we're lost in thought over weighty problems. At Walmart, if you have some important business problem on your mind, you should be bringing it out in the open at a Friday morning session called the merchandising meeting or at the Saturday morning meeting so we can all try to solve it together. But while we're doing all this work, we like to have a good time. It's sort of a whistle-while-you-work philosophy. And we not only have a heck of a good time with it, we work better because of it. We build spirit and excitement. We capture the attention of our folks and keep them interested, simply because they never know what's coming next. We break down barriers, which helps us communicate better with one another. And we make our people feel part of a family, in which no one is too important or too puffed up to lead a cheer or be the butt of a joke, or the target in a persimmon seed-spitting contest. We don't pretend to have invented the idea of a strong corporate culture, and we've been aware of a lot of the others that have come before us. In the early days of IBM, some of the things Tom Watson did with his slogans and group activities weren't all that different from the things we do. And as I've said, we've certainly borrowed every good idea we've come across. Helen and I picked up several ideas on a trip we took to Korea and Japan in 1975. A lot of the things they do over there are very easy to apply to doing business over here. Culturally, things seem so different, like sitting on the floor eating eels and snails. But people are people, and what motivates one group generally will motivate another. Helen Walton. Sam took me out to see this tennis ball factory somewhere east of Seoul. The company sold balls to Walmart, I guess, and they treated us very well. It was the dirtiest place I ever saw in my life, but Sam was very impressed. It was the first place he ever saw a group of workers have a company cheer, and he liked the idea of everybody doing calisthenics together at the beginning of the day. He couldn't wait to get home and try these ideas out in the stores and at the Saturday morning meeting. Back in 1984, people outside the company began to realize just how different we folks at Walmart are. That was the year I lost a bet to David Glass and had to pay up by wearing a grass skirt and doing the hula on Wall Street. I thought I would slip down there and dance, and David would videotape it so he could prove to everyone back at the Saturday morning meeting that I really did it. But when we got there, it turned out David had hired a truckload of real hula dancers and ukulele players, and he had alerted the newspapers and TV networks. We had all kinds of trouble with the police about permits, and the dancers' union wouldn't let them dance without heaters because it was so cold, and we finally had to get permission from the head of Merrill Lynch to dance on his steps. Eventually, though, I slipped on the grass skirt and the Hawaiian shirt and the lays over my suit and did what I think was a pretty fair hula. It was too good a picture to pass up, I guess, this crazy chairman of the board from Arkansas in this silly costume, and it ran everywhere. It was one of the few times one of our company stunts really embarrassed me. But at Walmart, when you make a bet like I did, that we couldn't possibly produce a pre-tax profit of more than 8%, you always pay up. Doing the hula was nothing compared to wrestling a bear, which is what Bob Schneider, once a warehouse manager in Palestine, Texas, had to do after he lost a bet with his crew that they couldn't beat a production record. Most folks probably thought we just had a wacky chairman who was pulling a pretty primitive publicity stunt. What they didn't realize is that this sort of stuff goes on all the time at Walmart. It's part of our culture, and it runs through everything we do, whether it's Saturday morning meetings or stockholders' meetings or store openings or just normal days. We always have tried to make life as interesting and as unpredictable as we can, and to make Walmart a fun proposition. We're constantly doing crazy things to capture the attention of our folks and lead them to think up surprises of their own. We like to see them do wild things in the stores that are fun for the customers and fun for the associates. If you're committed to the Walmart partnership and its core values, the culture encourages you to think up all sorts of ideas that break the mold and fight monotony. We know that our antics, our company cheers, or our songs, or my hula, can sometimes be pretty corny or hokey. We couldn't care less. Sure, it's a little strange for a vice president to dress in pink tights and a long blonde wig and ride a white horse around the Bentonville town square, as Charlie Self did in 1987, after he lost a Saturday morning meeting bet that December sales wouldn't top $1.3 billion. And it is odd for a former executive like Ron Lovelace to come out of retirement at every year-end meeting and present his annual LEIR report, the Lovelace Economic Indicator Report, based on the number of edible dead chickens found on the roadside, with charts and graphs and the whole bit. The harder times are, the fewer edibles you find on the roadside. Maybe it is a little hokey to surprise your president with the gift of a live pig, but that's what a Sam's Club crew did to David Glass at one meeting to kick off a sales competition with a football theme. They told him they had planned to give him a pigskin, then decided, what the heck, why not leave the pig in it? For that matter, how many other $50 billion companies would have their president put on overalls and a straw hat and ride a donkey around a parking lot? That's what we made David do at the Harrison store to make up for having told Fortune magazine his story about the donkey and the watermelons at that store's 1964 opening. Who knows what our competitors thought when they got their issue of Discount Store News that week and saw our president sitting on a jackass right there on the front page. Some of this culture grew naturally out of our small-town beginnings. Back then, we tried literally to create a carnival atmosphere in our stores. We were only in small towns then, and often there wasn't a whole lot else to do for entertainment that could beat going to the Walmart. As I told you, we'd have these huge sidewalk sales, and we'd have bands and little circuses in our parking lots to get folks to those sales. We'd have plate drops, where we'd write the names of prizes on paper plates and sail them off the roofs of the stores. We'd have balloon drops. We'd have moonlight madness sales, which usually would begin after normal closing hours and maybe last until midnight, with some new bargain or promotion being announced every few minutes. We'd play shopping cart bingo, where each shopping cart has a number, and if your number is called, you get a discount on whatever you have in the cart. At store openings, we'd stand on the service counters and give away boxes of candy to the customers who had traveled the farthest to get there. As long as it was fun, we'd try it. Occasionally, it blew up in our face. One year, on George Washington's birthday, Phil Green, remember the world's largest Tide display, ran an ad saying that his Fayetteville store was selling a television set for 22 cents, the birthday being on February 22nd. The only hitch was that before you could buy that television set, you had to find it first. Phil had hidden it somewhere in the store, and the first person to find it got it. When Phil arrived at the store that morning, there was such a crowd out front that you couldn't even see the doors. I think all of Fayetteville was there, and a lot of them had been there all night. Our folks had to go in through the back. When they finally opened the front doors, there was a stampede like you wouldn't believe. 500 or 600 people tearing through that store looking for one 22-cent television set. Phil sold a ton that day, but the place was so totally out of control that even he admitted playing hide-and-seek with merchandise was a terrible idea. As we've grown, we've gotten away from the circus approach, but we've made it a point to keep encouraging the spirit of fun in the stores. We want the associates and the management to do things together that contribute to the community and make them feel like a team, even if they don't directly relate to selling or promoting our merchandise. Here are a few of the crazy things I'm talking about. Our Fairbury, Nebraska store has a precision shopping cart drill team that marches in local parades. The members all wear Walmart smocks and push their carts through a routine of whirls, twirls, circles, and crossovers. Our Cedartown, Georgia store holds a Kiss the Pig contest to raise money for charity. They set out jars with each manager's name on them, and the manager whose jar winds up with the most donations has to kiss a pig. Our new Iberia, Louisiana store fields a cheerleading squad called the Shrinkettes. Their cheers deal mostly with, what else, cutting shrinkage. What do you do about shrinkage? Crush it. Crush it. The Shrinkettes stole the show at one of our annual meetings with cheers like, California oranges, Texas cactus. We think Kmart could use some practice. Our Fitzgerald, Georgia store won first place in the Irwin County Sweet Potato Parade with a float featuring seven associates dressed as fruits and vegetables grown in South Georgia. As they passed the judging stand, the homegrown fruits and vegetables did a homegrown Walmart cheer. Managers from our Ozark, Missouri store dressed up in pink tutus, got on the back of a flatbed truck, and cruised the town square on Friday night, the peak time for teenage cruisers, and somehow managed to raise money for charity by doing it. As you can see, we thrive a lot on the traditions of small-town America, especially parades with marching bands, cheerleaders, drill teams, and floats. Most of us grew up with it, and we found that it can be even more fun when you're an adult who usually spends all your time working. We love all kinds of contests, and we hold them all the time for everything from poetry to singing to beautiful babies. We like theme days, where everyone in the store dresses up in costume. Our Ardmore, Oklahoma store piled hay in front of the store one day, mixed $36 in coins in it, and let the kids dive into it. More of our stores than you would believe hold ladies' fashion shows using ugly old men from the stores as models. Some of our people greeters, the associates who meet our customers as they come in the door, use their high-profile positions to have a little fun. Artie Hopper, the greeter in Huntsville, Arkansas, dresses in a different costume for every holiday, including Hogfest, a local celebration. Then there's the World Championship Moon Pie Eating Contest. I already told you how I pushed moon pies as my item one year and sold $6 million worth, but the Moon Pie Contest started back in 1985 when John Love, an assistant manager at the time in Oneonta, Alabama, accidentally ordered 4 or 5 times more moon pies than he intended to, and found himself up to his eyeballs in them. Desperate, John came up with the idea of a moon pie eating contest as a way to move the moon pies out before they went bad on him. Who would have thought something like that would catch on? Now it's an annual event held every fall on the second Saturday in October, in the parking lot of our Oneonta store. It draws spectators from several states and has been written up in newspapers and covered by television literally all over the world. As of this writing, by the way, the world record for moon pie eating is 16 double-deckers in 10 minutes. It was set in 1990 by a guy named Mort Hurst, who bills himself as the Godzilla of gluttony. Corny? How could you get any cornier than that? But when folks get together and do this sort of silly stuff, it's really impossible to measure just how good it is for their morale. To know that you're supposed to have a good time, that there's no place for stuffed shirts, or at least that they always get their comeuppance, is a very uplifting thing for all of us. Take our Saturday morning meetings, for example. Without a little entertainment and a sense of the unpredictable, how in the world could we ever have gotten those hundreds of people, most of our managers and some associates from the general offices here in Bentonville, to get up every Saturday morning and actually come in here with smiles on their faces? If they knew all they could expect in that meeting was somebody droning on about comparative numbers, followed by a serious lecture on the problems of our business, could we have kept the meeting alive? No way. No matter how strongly I felt about the necessity of that meeting, the folks would have revolted. And even if we still held it, it wouldn't be any good at all. As it is, the Saturday morning meeting is at the very heart of the Walmart culture. Now, don't get me wrong, we don't get up and go down there just to have fun. That Saturday morning meeting is very much about business. Its purpose is to let everyone know what the rest of the company is up to. If we can, we find heroes among our associates in the stores and bring them into Bentonville, where we praise them in front of the whole meeting. Everybody likes praise. And we look for every chance we can to heap it on somebody. But I don't like to go to the meeting and hear about just the good things that are happening. I like to hear of what our weaknesses are, where we aren't doing as well as we should, and why. I like to see a problem come up and then hear suggestions as to how it can be corrected. If we decide we're doing something wrong, and the solution is obvious, we can order changes right then and carry them out over the weekend, while most everybody else in the retail business is off. The Saturday morning meeting is where we discuss and debate much of our philosophy and our management strategy. It is the focal point of all our communications efforts. It's where we share ideas we picked up from various places. And while it's not the most exciting part of the meeting, sometimes I like to read from management articles that pertain to our business. Two of our executives, Wesley Wright and Colin Washburn, seem to read just about everything there is in the way of management literature, and they're constantly calling useful articles or books to my attention. At the meeting, we'll talk about competitors, specifically, but also in general. For example, we'll spend 10 minutes talking about how Walmart can compete successfully with all the good specialty retailers coming onto the scene. It's often the place where we first decide to try things that seem unattainable. And instead of everybody shouting it down right away, we try to figure out how to make it work. That's exactly how I ended up dancing the hula on Wall Street, by making that bet at a Saturday morning meeting. And as embarrassing as it was to have to dance on Wall Street, believe me, achieving a pre-tax profit of more than 8%, when most everybody else in the retail industry averages about half that, made it well worth the red face. Al Miles. The great thing about the Saturday morning meeting is how totally unpredictable it is. Sometimes you get your soul bared in there. By that, I mean somebody may not have been doing their job so well, and they don't get publicly castigated, but they get gently chided in front of everybody. Or it can be a form of counseling. I'll never forget the chairman saying to me one time in front of everybody that I ought to stop and think sometimes before I talked. And I had it coming. I was really being derogatory in my remarks, really sticking it to another division of the company pretty hard, and it wasn't the right place to do it. I was publicly counseled in that meeting, and it stuck. Another time, the chairman decided I was going to have to stand up there and sing Red River Valley at a meeting 3 weeks away. He knew I couldn't carry a tune in a bucket, but he made a bigger and bigger deal out of it every week until finally I had to put a group together to sing it so nobody would hear only me. I always figured he just wanted to force me into doing something in public that I wasn't so good at, and that way I had to eat a little humble pie. Anyway, I believe these meetings are managed fun, and I think the chairman manages them very discreetly. He knows when he wants it to be serious, and he knows when he wants it to be fun. Sometimes it's very democratic, and sometimes it's very dictatorial. But he uses it for basically three purposes: to share information, to lighten everybody's load, and to rally the troops. Believe it or not, the majority of our folks wouldn't miss a Saturday morning meeting for anything. For the meeting to work, it has to be something of a show. We don't ever want to let it become predictable. One day we might do a few calisthenics. Another day we might sing, or maybe do the Razorback cheer. We don't want to plan it all out. We just want it to unfold. It is so unconventional that I don't think anyone could really duplicate it, even if they wanted to. We have lots of guests, and our folks never know who's going to be there. One day we might have an executive from a company we do business with. It might be somebody they never heard of from some small entrepreneurial outfit with a good idea, or it might be somebody like Jack Welch, the CEO of GE. On the other hand, it might be the comedian Jonathan Winters, who started coming to promote Hefty Bags, one of our vendors' products, and has returned several times. He really cracks everybody up. One time we had a mock boxing match between Sugar Ray Leonard and me. We asked a lot of athletes to join us, Sidney Moncrief, an NBA star and former Razorback great, is one of my favorites, and Fran Tarkenton, the former NFL quarterback, who does a lot of motivational talks, has also spoken at the meeting. Just recently, Garth Brooks, the country singer from Oklahoma, dropped by Walmart for a visit with some of our folks. Don Soderquist. One of the real values of our meeting is its spontaneity. We never really have an agenda. Of course, the chairman always has his yellow legal pad with notes scribbled on it of things he wants to discuss, and some of the rest of us do the same thing. But one of the things Sam will do is just call someone up at the start and say, "Okay, you conduct the whole meeting today." And that meeting will take on the personality of whoever's running it. That way, there's always a sense of anticipation. Something unusual may happen, or somebody may pull off something great. From the time we started the Saturday meeting with just four or five store managers getting together somewhere to talk merchandising, it has been a very difficult thing to develop, and there's been a lot of opposition to it, including from my own wife, who I've already told you believes it's unfair to take our folks away from their families on Saturday mornings. There have definitely been times when our folks would have voted it out if we had given them the opportunity. But, as I've said, I believe Saturday work is part of the commitment that comes with choosing a career in retail. I can't see asking our folks in the stores to make that sacrifice while our managers are off playing golf. Very few outsiders ever get to see our Saturday meetings, so the event that gives people the most insight into our corporate culture, the place where they really get a chance to see the Walmart chemistry in action, is our annual stockholders meeting. I told you how it began as an attempt to do something different for the analysts, taking them on float trips and making them camp out. But since then, it's grown into what is probably the largest corporate annual meeting in the world. It's gotten so big now, with over 10,000 shareholders and guests, that we hold it down in Fayetteville at Barnhill Arena, the University of Arkansas's basketball coliseum. Soon we'll be holding it in the new Bud Walton Arena they're building down there, and I know my brother will really take a lot of pride in that. In some ways, our annual meeting is a bigger version of the kind of show we have on Saturday mornings. We have entertainers like Reba McEntire, the popular country singer, and we have guest speakers. In other ways, it's a lot like the meetings of many companies, only louder. We make presentations to the shareholders, which focus on our accomplishments over the past year and on our goals and plans for the coming one. But what I think really sets our meeting apart is the degree to which we involve our associates, who, after all, are some of our most important shareholders. We have always included as many store managers and associates as possible in our annual meeting, to let them see the scope of the whole company and grasp the big picture. We started out letting every store and every distribution center elect an associate to represent them at the meeting. Because we've gotten so big now, I'm sorry to say we've had to stagger the thing. The distribution centers and the Sam's Clubs still send someone every year, but Walmart stores only send a delegate every other year. Really, the official part of the meeting takes a back seat to everything else we do. And a couple of times we've been having so much fun that we've actually forgotten to convene the real meeting. We gather our associates early on Friday morning, around 7 o'clock, for a real rousing warm-up. a pre-meeting meeting. We do our cheers and our songs and raise all sorts of cane. We salute retirees. We bring in all the department managers whose departments have the highest percentage of sales relative to their stores' overall sales. And we recognize the department managers who have the highest sales company-wide. We call up the truck drivers who've won the safety awards for the best driving records, and we honor them. We applaud associates who have created particularly successful displays, or who have won one of our VPI, volume-producing item, contests, and we honor them. The point is that we're not there to honor our shareholders as much as we are to let them meet the folks who are responsible for the amazing returns on their investments year after year. After the meeting, Helen and I invite all the associates who attend, about 2,500 of them, over to our house for a big picnic lunch catered by our own Walmart cafeteria. It's a lot of pressure on Helen. Not many wives would put up with that kind of crowd streaming through the yard in the house, but I think it's one of the best things we do. And in the end, both Helen and I really enjoy it a lot. It gives us a chance to visit with many of our associates who we would otherwise never get to see in a social setting like that. They tend to be the leaders in their stores, which is how they get elected to come. And even with that crush of people there, I still have the opportunity to ask them, how are we doing in Litchfield, Illinois? Or, how's your manager working out in Branson, Missouri? And in a very short time, I can get a pretty good idea from their level of enthusiasm just how things are going in a particular store. And if I hear something I don't like, I just might be out there visiting it within the next week or two. When the whole thing is over, the guest associates are sent a videotape of the meeting, and they're supposed to share that and their impressions of the meeting with their associates who didn't get to go. And, of course, we write a detailed account of the meeting in our company newspaper, Walmart World, so everybody gets a chance to read exactly what we did. We like to think that this kind of meeting brings us all closer together and creates the feeling that we are a family committed to one common interest. We want our associates to know and feel how much we as managers and major shareholders appreciate everything they are doing to make Walmart the great company that it is. Our strong corporate culture with its own unique personality, on top of the profit-sharing partnership we've created, gives us a pretty sharp competitive edge. But a culture like ours can create some problems of its own, too. The main one that comes to mind is a resistance to change. When folks buy into a way of doing things and really believe it's the best way, they develop a tendency to think that's exactly the way things should always be done. So I've made it my own personal mission to ensure that constant change is a vital part of the Walmart culture itself. I've forced change, sometimes for change's sake alone, at every turn in our company's development. In fact, I think one of the greatest strengths of Walmart's ingrained culture is its ability to drop everything and turn on a dime. We're great at that kind of change when it comes to operating challenges, but sometimes not so great on matters that have more to do with the culture of the company. In the early days, for example, all our old variety store managers had a tremendous prejudice against us hiring college boys because they didn't think they would work hard enough. Three of the first ones we hired, Bill Fields, Dean Sanders, and Colin Washburn, are still with us and, in fact, are among our brightest stars. But they had a heck of a time fitting in at first, and could probably tell some real horror stories. Bill Fields, Executive Vice President, Merchandising and Sales, Walmart. I had been with the company about 5 days, and we were opening a store in Idabel, Oklahoma. We had 13 days to open it, which is still a record. They worked me about 125 hours or more the first week. The second week it was getting worse. Then Sam, who knew who I was because I was a local Bentonville boy, comes walking up to me and says, "Who hired you?" I told him that Farrell Arendt had, and he said, "Well, do you think you'll ever be a merchant?" Just the way he said it made me mad enough to want to quit. Then Don Whitaker came walking up to me and looked at me almost like he smelled something bad and said, "Who in the hell hired you?" At the time, it didn't seem like going to college was much of an advantage in this company. We really had to prove ourselves to those old guys. Obviously, if we were going to grow, we had to bring in college-educated folks. But at first, the culture tried to reject them. And now that we have even more complicated needs in technology, finance, marketing, legal, whatever, our demand for a more sophisticated workforce is growing all the time. All this requires some basic changes in the way we think about ourselves, about who's a good Walmart hire for tomorrow, and about what we can do for the folks already on board. That's one reason Helen and I started the Walton Institute down at the University of Arkansas in Fort Smith. It's a place where our managers can go and get exposure to some of the educational opportunities they may not have had earlier on. Also, we as a company need to do whatever we can to encourage and help our associates earn their college degrees. We need these folks to get the best training they possibly can. It opens up their career opportunities, and it benefits us. Traditionally, we've had this attitude that if you wanted to be a manager at Walmart, you basically had to be willing to move on a moment's notice. You get a call that says you're going to open a new store 500 miles away. You don't ask questions. You just pack and go. Then sometime later, you worry about selling your house and moving your family. Maybe that was necessary back in the old days, and maybe it was more rigid than it needed to be. Now, though, it's not really appropriate anymore for several reasons. First, as the company grows bigger, we need to find more ways to stay in touch with the communities where we operate. And one of the best ways to do that is by hiring locally, developing managers locally, and letting them have a career in their home community, if they perform. Second, the old way really put good, smart women at a disadvantage in our company, because at that time they weren't as free to pick up and move as many men were. Now, I've seen the light on the opportunities we missed out on with women. I have to admit that Helen and my daughter Alice have helped me come around to this way of thinking. In the old days, retailers felt the same way about women that they did about college boys, only more so. In addition to thinking women weren't free to move, they didn't think women could handle anything but the clerk jobs because the managers usually did so much physical labor, unloading trucks and hauling merchandise out of the stockroom on a two-wheeler, mopping the floors and cleaning the windows if necessary. Nowadays, the industry has waked up to the fact that women make great retailers. So we at Walmart, along with everybody else, have to do everything we possibly can to recruit and attract women. One other aspect of the Walmart culture, which has attracted some attention, is simply a matter of lifestyle. But it is one that has bothered me ever since we began to be really successful. The fact is, a lot of folks in our company have made an awful lot of money. We've had lots and lots of millionaires in our ranks, and it just drives me crazy when they flaunt it. Maybe it's none of my business, but I've done everything I can to discourage our folks from getting too extravagant with their homes and their automobiles and their lifestyles. As I said earlier, I just don't believe the lifestyle here in Bentonville should be much different than what would be high moderate income in most other places. But from time to time, I've had a hard time holding back folks who have never had the opportunity to get their hands on the kind of money they've made with their Walmart stock holdings. Every now and then, somebody will do something particularly showy, and I don't hesitate to rant and rave about it at the Saturday morning meeting. And a lot of times, folks who just can't hold back will go ahead and leave the company. It goes back to what I said about learning to value a dollar as a kid. I don't think that big mansions and flashy cars are what the Walmart culture is supposed to be about. It's great to have the money to fall back on, and I'm glad some of these folks have been able to take off and go fishing at a fairly early age. That's fine with me. But if you get too caught up in that good life, it's probably time to move on, simply because you lose touch with what your mind is supposed to be concentrating on, serving the customer. Chapter 12. Making the Customer Number One. Sam Walton understands better than anyone else that no business can exist without customers. He lives by his credo, which is to make the customer the centerpiece of all his efforts. And in the process of serving Walmart's customers to perfection, not quite perfection, he would say, he also serves Walmart's associates, its share owners, its communities, and the rest of its stakeholders in an extraordinary fashion, almost without parallel in American business. Roberto C. Goizueta, Chairman and CEO, The Coca-Cola Company. For my whole career in retail, I have stuck by one guiding principle. It's a simple one, and I have repeated it over and over and over in this book, until I'm sure you're sick to death of it. But I'm going to say it again anyway. The secret of successful retailing is to give your customers what they want. And really, if you think about it from your point of view as a customer, you want everything. A wide assortment of good quality merchandise, the lowest possible prices, guaranteed satisfaction with what you buy, friendly, knowledgeable service, convenient hours, free parking, a pleasant shopping experience. You love it when you visit a store that somehow exceeds your expectations. And you hate it when a store inconveniences you or gives you a hard time or just pretends you're invisible. I learned this lesson as a merchant in small towns, which is where I've spent my whole life. For those of you who've been around as long as I have and who spent your early days in small towns too, it's not hard to remember how different small town life was in the first half of this century. Newport was a pretty prosperous little town with a fairly competitive retail environment, but it's still a good example of how things worked back then. It was a cotton town, which meant that a lot of the folks who shopped there really lived outside of town on farms. Most of the men worked long hours in the fields, and most of the women worked at home. Very few women held jobs in those days, although a lot of them had worked during the war. And they were beginning to think about going back to work when they got their families pretty well underway. The town itself had several small department stores, including, as I mentioned earlier, a Penny's, and for a while that little Eagle store I opened up. It also had a couple of good variety stores, mine and John Dunham's Sterling store. There were drug stores, hardware stores, tire and auto stores like Firestone and Western Auto, and little family grocery stores. In lots of little towns, you didn't even have many one-stop groceries. You might have one shop that specialized in butchering meat, another that carried good fresh vegetables, and maybe another that would wring a chicken's neck and dress it for you right there behind the counter while you waited. Folks back then weren't accustomed to all the variety and abundance of goods and services that we have available today. During the Depression, few of us had enough money to shop very often, and during World War II, everything, meat, butter, tires, shoes, gasoline, sugar, was rationed. But by the time I started out, the shortages were pretty much over, and the economy was growing. Compared to the depression we had been used to, boom times had arrived. In a farm-to-market town like Newport, the big shopping day was always Saturday. That's when the whole family would drive to town and spend a few hours, maybe the whole day, walking around looking for what they needed in all the stores. Something had to attract them to a particular store, maybe a combination of things. The storekeeper's personality, the freshness of the goods, the prices, an ice cream machine. We thrived in that competitive environment. When we arrived in the much smaller town of Bentonville in 1950,